We saw Christ in the Pentateuch on the basis of implication, the very words that are used to describe God. Not only Elohim, but we could have talked about El Shaddai, which we did not. We have plural expressions. Let us make man in our image. Well, who was talking to who? God is in existence, and he is talking to another person of the Godhead. God the Father is the one who worketh all things according to the counsel of his own will, Ephesians 1:11. Jesus Christ is the second person of the Godhead. He is the one who executes the plan that God the Father devises. And then the Holy Spirit is the power source by which these things are done. So just by on the basis of implication, we already have Jesus Christ, the second person of the Godhead, even in the very first verse and the first chapter, and then all throughout the rest of the Bible. In the second place, we talked about Christophanies. I told you that I don't want to be dogmatic about this, but I was interested in the number of people who wanted to talk a little about Christophanies afterward. In fact, there was a very young one who wanted to talk about Christophanies, and then a middle-aged one, and then there was an old one this evening when I came in. So across the board, there was an interest in Christophanies. Well, I'm calling them that, and this is an expression that is well known in the literature that people write about the Old Testament. I don't want to press the point too far. There are places where you wonder, well, is that the Archangel Michael or some other created angel? Or would that be the pre-incarnate Christ? Sometimes you can't always tell when the angel of the Lord or some such personage is mentioned. However, sometimes it seems to me that it can be none other than the pre-incarnate Christ. Let me show you an example of what I'm talking about, since we've had all age categories mention this, and there was in the young one who asked about it, there may have been a bit of confusion. Let me just set the stage for this by going back to the book of Revelation for a moment in chapter 19 of the book of Revelation. Here we have the Apostle John being led on tour and being instructed by an angel, and I think you're well familiar with this. He's being instructed by an angel. And when the angel gets to a certain point in his touring and in his things that he's saying to the Apostle John, we read in Revelation chapter 19, verse 10, John says, referring to the angel, "I fell at his feet to worship him." Interesting, huh? "I fell at the feet of the angel to worship him. And he said unto me, see thou do it not. I am thy fellow servant and of thy brethren which have the testimony of Jesus, worship God." All throughout the Bible we see that God is the one whom we are to worship. We worship God, we do not worship created beings. And so the angel says, don't worship me. The apostle Peter, when Cornelius falls down in front of him, Peter says, stand up, I myself also am a man. So we don't worship men, we don't worship angels. On over in the 22nd chapter of the book of Revelation, just three chapters over, we see this again. Revelation 22, verse 8. "I, John, saw these things and heard them, and when I had heard and seen, I fell down to worship before the feet of the angel which showed me these things." John was just so overwhelmed by what he was seeing and hearing, and this angel was such a magnificent creation of God. The Apostle John, who really should have known better, but I think he was just carried away with what was going on, he said that he fell down to worship before the feet of the angel which showed me these things. And again in verse 9, "Then said he unto me, see thou do it not, for I am thy fellow servant and of thy brethren the prophets, and of them which keep the sayings of this book, worship God." We have this as a firmly established principle. Do not worship God's creation, worship God. Now I'd like to have you go, if you're turning, to the book of Joshua chapter 5, which I think is a rather clear-cut case. At least it is to me. You can see what you think about it. Joshua chapter 5, verse 13. "And it came to pass, when Joshua was by Jericho, that he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, there stood a man over against him with his sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went unto him and said unto him, art thou for us or for our adversaries? And he said, nay, but as the captain of the host of the Lord," that's Jehovah. When we have capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D, that is the YHWH, the unpronounceable Yahweh or Jehovah. "As the captain of the host of the Lord, Jehovah, am I now come. And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and did worship and said unto him, what saith my Lord unto his servant? And the captain of the hosts of the Lord's host said unto Joshua, loose thy shoe from off thy foot, for the place whereon thou standest is holy. And Joshua did so. Twice in the book of Revelation, we saw the apostle John fall at the feet of a created angel, and the angel said, don't do that. Only worship God. Here, Joshua falls at the feet of this personage, and this personage has every opportunity to say the same thing. Don't worship me. Stand up. Just only worship God. That's not done here. Who do we worship? We worship God. Joshua worships before the feet of this personage, and this personage does not say, don't do it. Kind of reminds me of when the Apostle Thomas, in amazement, said to Jesus, or of Jesus, in the book of John, my Lord and my God. If there was ever a time for Jesus to correct somebody if he was not God, that would have been the time. Don't call me God. But he didn't. He didn't correct it because it was not wrong. Jesus Christ was God in the flesh. Jesus Christ was God before he came in the flesh. And it seems to me that here in this latter part of the fifth chapter of the book of Joshua, we may have a clear-cut case of a Christophany, the pre-incarnate Christ being worshipped by Joshua and nothing's being said askance or amiss about Joshua doing worshiping of this personage. Anyway, I submit that. Now, I stepped outside the Pentateuch itself proper to give you that example of a Christophany. But as I said this morning, I think we have at least numerous possible examples of this in the book of Genesis, Exodus, and elsewhere in the Pentateuch. Anyway, we went on from that to talking about the types of Christ in the Old Testament. And then we were talking about prophecy. When we had to conclude this morning, we were talking about Genesis 3:15, the first messianic prophecy. And I'm sorry we had to interrupt that right in the middle, but if we're going to expect you to come back, at least I can do is quit on time. So I did short-circuit that a bit. This is a very important prophecy, and as far as I know, the very first one that we have in the Bible anywhere. Genesis 3:15, the proto-evangelium, the first gospel. God told the devil, I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed, and he shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel. Now, the New Testament does not specifically quote Genesis 3:15 anywhere. Nevertheless, it does allude to it on a number of occasions, and it shows the messianic fulfillment of it. The serpent in Genesis 3 is clearly identified as Satan in the New Testament in Revelation chapter 20. Revelation 20 refers to the old serpent and identifies him as Satan. In 2 Corinthians chapter 11, Paul said that Eve was beguiled by the serpent in his craftiness, and then 11 verses later in the same context, Paul says that even Satan transforms himself into an angel of light. And in Romans 16 verse 20, Paul says that God will shortly crush Satan under your feet. The crushing of Satan there in Romans 16:20, right at the end of the Roman letter, is surely an obvious allusion to Genesis 3:15 and the crushing of the serpent's head. Christ the seed would come to earth through woman. And the implication here is of his birth, and I think even of the virgin birth, the seed of a woman, not the seed of a man, but the seed of a woman. The thing I wanted to tell you this morning is that in ancient times, many people did not understand human reproduction. In fact, a great many people did not. It was thought, really until fairly modern times, that a man contains within his body the complete microscopic baby. It's so small you can't see the baby, but the complete microscopic baby is contained within the body of the man. And the man in procreation merely transmits this to the woman, and the woman really is merely a glorified incubator to get that baby to the place where it is able to be big enough to come out into the world and to bring it to a viable size and development. But the woman really was considered to be not necessary for reproduction. And this is why in the founding of ancient Rome, the mythology there, you have babies just hatching out of the mud, Romulus and Remus. Somehow they had been deposited in the mud, and the mud warmed up and just hatched them out of the mud. You didn't need a woman for reproduction at all. There were doctoral dissertations at major universities like Harvard University written as recently as 1694 espousing this very theory. The first photograph of a human egg, first photograph of a human ovum was taken in 1922. But Moses, 1500 years before Christ, is writing about the seed of the woman. When the fullness of the times was come, God sent forth his son, made of a woman, not a man and a woman, but made of a woman, made under the law, to redeem them that are under the law. That's Genesis 3:15, and Christ is the fulfillment of that. Jesus Christ went to the cross and he suffered death, that he was death that was introduced into the world by the devil. John 8:44 says that the devil was a murderer from the beginning. Christ tasted death because Satan, through Adam, had introduced death into the world. Wherefore, by one man, sin entered into the world, and death by sin. And so death passed upon all men. Romans 5, verse 12. Christ's heel had to be bruised in that he had to suffer death. He was slowed down for that period of 3 days and three nights. And that is a figure of speech as well that was well known to the Jews. But that's another issue. Christ's heel had to be bruised in that he had to suffer death. But it was only a bruising of the heel. It was only going to slow him down. It was going to cause him some pain, but it was not going to put a stop to him. Then the final act has still not yet been seen. In the 20th chapter of the book of Revelation, Satan is cast into the lake of fire. His head will be crushed and crushed forever. Don't ever judge the outcome by the way things look currently. You can get very depressed if you do that. It may look like Satan has the upper hand, and maybe in some instances he does have for now. But he will never win. He is already a defeated foe. He's lashing out his death throes. He knows that he's defeated. He has been defeated but not destroyed. And so he's still lashing. He's still able to hurt us. But greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world. Genesis 3:15 is a marvelous prophecy of the coming of Christ and his identification with us as humankind through the seed of the woman. Now I'd like to mention a couple more prophecies to you. The great promise to Abraham, first of all, beginning in Genesis 12, that was being talked about this morning in our class. Genesis 12, and then recurring after that, in Genesis 22, verse 18, again we have, "In thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed." Paul tells us the meaning of this in the third chapter of the Galatian letter when he says that Moses did not say seeds as of many, but thy seed, which is Christ. The inspired Paul tells us what the emphasis was in Genesis 22. God, when he talked through Moses there, was thinking about a single seed, Christ, as the fulfillment of the promise made to Abraham. And notice the universal thrust there, that in thy seed shall all the nations be blessed. We need to understand the universal nature of God's love and operation in Old Testament times, as well as in New Testament times and today. God is not just the God of the Jews. He selected them to be the channel through whom the Messiah would come. But he was interested, always was interested, in other nations as well. In fact, he wanted them to all be a part of his family. They are the ones that rejected him. He did not reject them until they rejected him. When every nation chose its own God, then the God of heaven chose himself a nation. And most of the Old Testament is about the Jewish nation because this was the way that he developed the ability for the Messiah to come into the world to save the whole world. But the book of Jonah shows God's universal love when Jonah is sent to preach to the Gentiles of ancient Nineveh. The Old Testament theme is developed along the lines of the coming of Christ. And that's why we have the predominant emphasis on the Jews. But we really need to remember, in view of some of the current doctrines about God's covenant relationship with the Jews and his non-interest in those who are outside and their irresponsibility to his laws and so forth, God has always been interested in everybody, and he's still interested in everybody. Back in the Old Testament times, anybody could come to Christ. And we have examples of a number of Gentiles who did throughout the Old Testament. They could come to the Lord at any time back then. I wanted to mention to you one more prophecy. And that's in the book of Genesis as well, in Genesis chapter 49, verse 10. In Genesis 49, verse 10, we have Jacob on his deathbed, giving the blessings and a few curses as well to his sons as they're standing around his bed. He's just about to die. When he comes to Judah, he says this in verse 10. "The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh come, and unto him shall the gathering of the people be." This is an amazing prophecy. It's in the Pentateuch, but it foretells the coming of Christ from the tribe of Judah, and it gives a time indicator as to when he would come. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh come, and unto him shall the gathering of the people be. There was common consensus of opinion among the Jewish commentators all through the centuries that Shiloh referred to the Messiah. It's only been a recent modernistic theory that has attempted to divorce Genesis 49:10 from a messianic application. Shiloh is he who provides peace or rest. The very word Shiloh comes from the word for peace. Him to whom rulership rightfully belongs. And the scepter, of course, is the king's instrument, signifying the authority that is regal. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh comes. So according to this, we know that Shiloh is coming. We know that he's coming from the tribe of Judah. And we know that the ruling capacity of Judah will not depart until Shiloh does come. We know that after the arrival of Shiloh, the ruling capacity of Judah will depart. We know all that from this verse. Now, when Jesus was born, the Jews, who were by then primarily the tribe of Judah, although they were under Rome, they had their own king. His name was Herod. He was the king of the Jews. Actually, he was a half-Idumean, but he was recognized by all his contemporaries as a Jew. And when Herod died, according to Matthew chapter 2, verse 22, Archelaus, his son, did reign in Judea in the place of his father Herod. Archelaus was a king. Archelaus was reigning. The scepter had not departed from Judah. But in 7 AD, Archelaus was deposed from his regal authority. Because he had made a royal mess of things, and so they finally got rid of him. He was badly in trouble with Rome. They just kicked him off the throne. Beginning in 7 AD, the Jews were henceforth governed by a procurator who was directly responsible to Rome. There was one after another of these procurators. The most famous one of them, of course, was Pontius Pilate that we're all familiar with. But they were governed by one Roman procurator after another, not by a king again. In 7 AD, the scepter departed from Judah. But according to Genesis 49:10, the scepter was not to depart from Judah until Shiloh came. Therefore, sometime before 7 AD, Shiloh did come, if Genesis 49:10 is correct. In view of Genesis 49:10, we can't go beyond 7 AD and expect a Messiah to come into the world. For the most part, the Jews of our time, you can find them all around us here in the Kansas City area. We've got lots and lots of Jewish people, Jewish descendancy in the Kansas City area. You talk to them, and unless they are Orthodox, if they're conservative even, or Reformed definitely, they have pretty much given up the idea of a coming personal Messiah. Many are suggesting that the Messiah is not an individual at all. Rather, the Messiah is a sort of a concept or an ideal. And when the Jews eventually evolve into a certain idealized spiritual state of consciousness, then that is the Messiah that was to come. But boy, that's not the way the prophets viewed it in the Old Testament. The prophets in the Old Testament saw the Messiah as an individual. He was led as a sheep to the slaughter. And the Bible tells us here in Genesis 49:10 that he had to arrive before 7 AD. And he did. Born in Bethlehem of Judea before 7 AD. It's a perfect fit. All these prophecies, it was like the Lord was shooting arrows at a bullseye. This one tells a time frame that the Lord would come. Daniel 9 tells a time frame. Micah 5:2 told the place that he would be born. All these arrows coming from different directions and from different writers hitting the same bullseye. Anyway, that's the end of the lesson for this morning. But since we have a little extra time, if you don't mind, I'd like to go a step further with you with regard to the Pentateuch. Did Moses write the Pentateuch at all? We were referring to this morning as the books of Moses. Commonly, and all through the years, this has been referred to as the writing of Moses. And now we live in a day when we're constantly being told that Moses lived too early to have written the Pentateuch. And that the Pentateuch contains information that Moses could not have known during his lifetime. Many details from a later age have been inserted into the book of Genesis, for example, people will say. And we're told that the Pentateuch was pieced together from various sources, called the J source and the E source and the D source, the P source, at a fairly late date, long after Moses' death. These sources were supposedly written at different times and by different authors. Now, the idea that Moses did not write the Pentateuch has been around for more than 1,000 years, but until the mid-17th century, the vast majority of people thought and believed that Moses did write it. It was in the middle of the 17th century that the Dutch philosopher Benedict Spinoza seriously questioned the writing of the Pentateuch by Moses. And there was a French physician by the name of Astruc who developed the original documentary hypothesis in 1753. This was revised by a man by the name of Graff and was restated by Wellhausen in the 19th century. And sometimes it's still called the Graff-Wellhausen hypothesis. The burden behind this, the JEPD thing, says that you have somebody who was writing and they were calling deity Jehovah, like we have in Genesis chapter 2. The Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being. You don't find that name for God in Genesis 1, but you find it in chapter 2. So there is the Jehovah writer, and then there is the Elohim writer, which we talked about this morning from Genesis 1. There is the Deuteronomist, and then there is also the priestly source, the J-E-D-P theory. And each one of these was written at a different time. The Jehovahist or the Yahwehist was supposed to have written about 850 B.C. The Elohist was supposed to have written 750 B.C. The Deuteronomist, 620 B.C. And the priestly source containing most of the priestly law, about 500 B.C. And supposedly all of this then was edited together about 200 B.C. And people who really go a long way with this, I read one man one time, and he took one verse out of the book of Genesis and found three different authorships in that one verse. Now, how you can actually do that and convince anybody, I don't know. But he claimed that three different writers had obviously written this one verse in the book of Genesis. My point for bringing this up is that it is an increasingly popular theory in our time. Numerous commentaries that you might read promote this theory. In many scholarly circles, if you don't believe this, you're considered uneducated and even fanatical. But I want to tell you tonight that one of the first assumptions that this theory rested on when it was first brought to view was disproven a long time ago. You ever noticed how theories are built on something that's supposed to be fact, and then if the fact is removed, the theory often remains anyhow? Well, that's what's happened here. It was assumed that Moses lived prior to the time of written language. And that's why Moses couldn't have written the Pentateuch, because Moses was a primitive man without an alphabet even. That was believed for some time. Now we know, and it's conclusively determined, that writing was known long before Moses' time. The Code of Hammurabi was found over 100 years ago at Susa in what is now Iran. It was written hundreds of years before Moses on a piece of hard black stone, almost 8 feet high, and it contains some laws that are similar to some of the ones that Moses wrote. People can no longer say that Moses was a primitive man without an alphabet. People can no longer say that Moses' laws were too advanced for his time. There have been other finds as well, showing that writing goes way back before Moses. So one of the foundational assumptions for this JEPD theory, and what that it rests on, has been shattered. Numerous references in the Pentateuch are said to be from a later time, that they are anachronisms which could not possibly be the work of Moses. For instance, in the 36th chapter of the book of Genesis. Now, I don't know if anything springs to mind when I say Genesis 36. It may not, because it's probably the least studied chapter in the book of Genesis. And by looking at Genesis 36, you can see why it would be the least studied. It just gives us basically the genealogy of Esau there. And it's one of the most boring chapters in the book of Genesis generally, because we have very little to connect to it. But here's the statement I want you to notice in Genesis 36:31. These are the kings that reigned in the land of Edom before there reigned any king over the children of Israel. Now, people will look at that and say, well, how did Moses know about any king reigning over the children of Israel? In Moses' day, they never had a king over Israel. So somebody must have come along later and written this, because they knew about the kings of Israel. The claim is made that this passage could have only been written after the first king began to reign in the nation of Israel. And, of course, Moses died hundreds of years before Saul. But consider this. Moses knew about the promises that God had made to Abraham and Jacob concerning the future kings of Israel. In fact, the Lord actually promised that Sarah would be a mother of nations and kings of people shall come from her. Genesis chapter 17, verse 6. Just one chapter before what we were talking about in Genesis 36, in Genesis chapter 35, verse 11. Jacob was promised that kings shall come out of thy loins. So Genesis 36:31 was written with that promise in mind. And is saying that Edom became a kingdom before Israel did. That's all it's really saying there. You know the story. Esau sold his birthright and he boiled stew. He had everything in hand and very little in promise. Whereas Jacob was just the opposite. Jacob or Israel had everything in promise and little in hand. Moses was inspired. That's the bottom line. He was given special revelation from God. And through Moses, the statement was made in Deuteronomy 17, verses 14 and 15, that when you come into the land that God's going to give you, he will set a king over you, whom the Lord your God chooses. So Moses, having some superior knowledge, some knowledge about the future here, is not a problem. Rather, it's to be expected of a man who is inspired. But there are always people quibbling about the Pentateuch. Moses could have written the Pentateuch. He got some things wrong and so forth. Here's an interesting thing. There are 23 references to camels in the book of Genesis. But it is claimed that by modern critics that domesticated camels were unknown in the times that the book of Genesis records. The book of Genesis has quite a bit to say about camels. It claims that they were in Egypt in the time of Abraham, that they were in the Promised Land in the days of Isaac, that they were in Padan Aram while Jacob was working for Laban there, and that they were owned by the Midianites to whom Joseph was sold by his brothers when they pulled him out of the pit. As far as I know, the modern critics who claim that domesticated camels were unknown in the times that Genesis record have been unable to prove that. They can't even produce one solid piece of evidence in support of that claim. They just make the claim and expect to be believed about that. Actually, evidence has been discovered that shows that camels were domesticated during and long before the time of Abraham. We found camel's hair ropes on more than one occasion. We have found pottery camels. How do you make a pottery camel if you don't have a camel to look at? We have found camel bones even. Again, part of the problem is that once an idea gets into the literature, it's hard to shake there even when that idea is disproven. At Hama in Syria, they came across a figurine from the second millennium before Christ. This is way back, real early, from the second millennium before Christ. The excavator thought it might be a horse, even though it had a strange hump in the middle of its back, but he thought it must be a horse because he knew it couldn't be a camel because camels weren't there that early. Well, that's good old circular reasoning. Sometimes we get blamed for that, and sometimes we're guilty of it, but we're not the only ones. Sometimes the opponents of the Bible are guilty of circular reasoning as well. Camels have been around since creation. Why wouldn't these early desert people have domesticated and used these indispensable creatures? They didn't have semis. The camel was the semi of the ancient world, and it got a lot of miles per gallon, too. All the evidence points to the limited use of the camel before and during Abraham's time. People talk about Moses' knowledge of gates in places like Deuteronomy chapter 15, verse 22. And sometimes they have a problem with this. How can Moses talk about walled cities and talk about within thy gates and so forth? Now, the phrase within thy gates occurs in the Pentateuch about 25 times. But the expression is sometimes used to refer to just an entrance to an area of dwelling. It's used that way in Exodus 32, verse 26. Moses stood in the gate of the camp. Doesn't mean that there was a big wooden swinging gate there. In fact, the New King James Version just translates that as an entrance. They certainly didn't have walls with gates in them around their Bedouin-styled tent city, of course. But Moses could also have been referring to the cities that the Israelites would capture in the future. It's not a problem either way. If we give the Bible the benefit of the doubt, we find that it hangs together very well and that there's every reason to believe that Moses did write the Pentateuch. But let me ask you this as we get ready to conclude. Does it really matter who wrote the Pentateuch? I believe it does for the following reason. Both the Old Testament and the New Testament claim that Moses wrote it. In the Hebrew Bible, Genesis through Deuteronomy was considered one unit. Each book in that one unit presupposes the one that precedes it. Without Genesis, Exodus reads like a book that just starts in the middle. Without Exodus, Leviticus is a complete mystery. And so there are really five separate volumes, but they're in the same category. There were five divisions in the same book. Hence, references to the law or the book of these five. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Notice the way that the Bible talks about these books. For instance, in the words of our Lord himself, in Luke chapter 24, verse 27, beginning at Moses, Luke is recording this and telling what the Lord did. Beginning at Moses, what's he talking about? He's talking about the Pentateuch. Beginning at Moses and all the prophets, he expounded unto them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself. He's using a figure of speech here called zeugma, which is a form of ellipsis, where he just refers to the author, and by that he means the things that that author wrote. Beginning at Moses, he expounded unto them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself. The Jews had a habitual practice of publicly reading the law. Acts 15:21. The statement is made there that Moses has had throughout many generations those who preach him in every city. What's that mean? That means they're reading the Pentateuch, the books of Moses, the books of the law, being read in the synagogues every Sabbath. This is a figure of speech called metonymy. There are over 200 different kinds of figures of speech used in the Bible, and it's important sometimes to recognize what it is that's being used. This is a figure of speech called metonymy where it refers to Moses, but it's talking about what he wrote. John 1:45, the statement was made there, "We have found him of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." And again, John 5:46-47, Jesus said, "If you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote of me. If you do not believe his writings, how will you believe my words?" So when we claim that Moses did not write the Pentateuch, we're claiming that Jesus was mistaken. Jesus said, if you believed Moses, you would believe me. If Jesus was mistaken, he wasn't the Son of God. We can't believe in Jesus Christ without believing that Moses wrote and what Moses wrote. Jesus believed the Pentateuch, and he was believed it was written by Moses, and we believe it too, starting with page 1. So that's a conclusion. We're right at 6 o'clock. We need to conclude once again with the Lord's invitation.